The next case this morning is 23-3136 Lawson v. Spirit AeroSystems. Counsel for the appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed, please.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Joseph Bayo, counsel for the plaintiff appellant Larry Lawson. Your Honors, this is a contract case where the terms of the contracts, as well as their impact on the parties and the public, must be examined under Kansas law. Mr. Lawson respectfully submits that in reaching its decision, the district court ignored important contractual language and ultimately applied the wrong legal standard. And it did that when it held that the non-compete clause in this case is enforceable to forfeit the bulk of the compensation that Mr. Lawson had already earned as Spirit CEO without any consideration of whether the terms of the clause are unreasonable or overbroad.
Help me with this point about already earned. I thought the question was that these stock options had to vest and that they had not vested at that time. Is that not right?
Well, Your Honor, there is a vesting requirement, but the award of the stock itself is compensation.
Well, but it had, these options had no monetary value, right, until they vested?
They had a great deal of monetary value. It just couldn't be converted into cash unless it passed the vesting. But that's what we are challenging. We're challenging the enforceability of the provision that prevented him from getting the money. Obviously, in every case where there is a challenge of the provision that is non-compete, something is not met. So the vesting did not occur. But all of the cases, and the judge himself in the trial court, in the findings, said this was earned, the stock was earned, and the stock has value, because only one person testified about it, to the tune of $28 million.
Okay, let me just clarify for my yes. own purposes. Isn't there a distinction with a difference between a scenario in which, let's say, there is a concrete pot of money, named $10 million, that the company says, if you go through this period where you're a consultant for us for a year, you will get your $10 million. You know, this is your money. All you have to do is do your year, and you get the $10 million. Isn't there a distinction between that and a scenario in which, and so it is his money. I mean, they've given it to him. They just say you can't claim it. Isn't there a distinction?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think the Varney case really, really rejects that notion. The fact is that he had these stock rights and they were taken away. The value was taken away by virtue of the clause. The same thing happens when you're talking about a pot of money. This is like a pot of money that is sitting there. Now, there is something that needs to occur before you can get the pot of money, but that's what this was. This was a defined body of stock that if he was entitled to it would be the equivalent of $28 million.
Yes, but you have to meet certain conditions in order to get the money. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, isn't there a distinction between a situation in which you have to meet certain conditions, you're alleged not to have met the conditions, therefore you forfeit that, in a situation in which actually somebody is taking money out of your pocket? In other words, a scenario in which it is your money, and if you do this, you will face a penalty. We will take X amount of money from you. A
couple of things, Your Honor. I think it's the same thing. I do think
there's no distinction between those two scenarios.
That there's no difference in connection with, is it a pot of money or is it stock that's worth $10 million?
And I apologize. My hypothetical initially probably was not as artful as it was intended to be. I guess what I'm getting at is there a distinction with a difference between a situation in which you face a penalty in the sense that somebody takes something from you that you have, okay, says, okay, if you don't do this, you've got to pay us $10 million.
Yes.
a difference between that and a scenario in which if you don't do this, we won't give you $10 million.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's the same thing. It's $10 million that's sitting there, whether it's in the form of stock that was awarded. And by the way, the stock was awarded and got its value because Mr. Lawson did his job. He turned around a company that was in desperate shape. So that the stock itself was the reward and its value was the result of what he did.
But
go ahead, Your Honor.
Assume you're going at the distinction that we've been looking at with the wording of the contract, a condition precedent.
Yes.
Which is you can contract for that, and it's a condition of which if you meet, you get it. If you don't meet it, you don't get it. I mean, it's that's the way a condition precedent works.
Well, yes, Your Honor, except that the condition precedent here, the foundation of it is a non-compete clause, which itself is overbroad.
Well, that's what we're arguing about right now.
Yes.
What you're arguing
that's
about.
That's correct. Now, we end up, just to make it clear, even if it's just a forfeiture, this is not a forfeiture for competition provision. It is an out-and-out prohibition, Your Honor.
Prohibition for what?
Prohibition to do any of the things that he did. It's not just the forfeiture provision.
They specifically adopted in the consulting agreement.
Yes.
The employment agreement. That comes in that way. But he's not being denied employment. He's being denied the opportunity to earn under the condition precedent.
But the clause, when you read the language, it's all prohibitive. Even the court, the panel before this, concluded that not only did it prevent him from that's the word they used, prevent him from competing, it prevented him from that very long daisy chain, starts with no competition.
Did this prevent him from doing anything that he otherwise could have done under the terms of the contract?
Absolutely. It prevented him from not competing, but working or having a consultancy arrangement with a company, Elliott, that didn't compete. That's a huge, I mean, that's the problem with the clause. And that's exactly what this court, what the trial court enforced.
Well, but he understood that from the get-go, because I have to admit, when I was reading the district court's order the second time around,
yes,
the gentleman saw a problem to the point of where, according to the district court, he can't lose because he's been indemnified.
But the indemnification is...
He can't lose. I mean, there's nothing he's losing.
Sure, he does, Your Honor. First of all, the indemnification has nothing to do with whether Kansas is going to enforce an overbroad non-compete.
No, my point is he recognizes that there's a problem here in entering into all of this.
Well, he actually...
Otherwise, he wouldn't have agreed. He wouldn't have an indemnification for himself.
They threatened him. They said, out and out, you are violating. They didn't say that we're just going to forfeit. They said, you are violating the non-compete clause here. That's what they told him. Of course, he sought, if he could get it, coverage. He did not get complete coverage, by the way. There's still $5 million that he's out as a result of what was done. But that has nothing to do with whether the reasonableness test is supposed to apply. And the court here, in the lower court...
Well, excuse me for interrupting you.
Sure.
But your argument is that there's automatically a violation of the reasonableness because it wasn't even considered.
Well, no. It's two parts, Your Honor. The first part is... Reasonableness test in Kansas applies. It applies to every non-compete clause, irrespective of the remedy that's sought. It's not remedy-driven. It's what is the restriction? That was made very clear in the Idbis case. So the restriction itself here is, I think everybody has recognized, overbroad. Very, very, very broad. In fact, no one has cited a single case that has enforced a clause that goes that far.
Go ahead. The question is, whether this is a traditional non-compete and is consistent with or tracks the policies that have been at play that requires a reasonableness test.
Yes.
And part of those policies is the question of whether you are prohibited from working.
Yes.
And you aren't prohibited. Well, to some extent, there were things that he could do. He could not be in that lane that involved him being directly in competition with his former firm. But I think there's stuff in the record to suggest there are things he could do.
No, I don't think there is, Your Honor. In fact, there is nothing in the record that says he could do X or Y. In fact, because he's not allowed to have an indirect interest in a company that invests in or services or has ever consulted another company, which company is not even a competitor. It's in the same business, which is very broadly defined. That takes out a universe, as he testified, and as Ms. Marnick testified for the other side. He could do only what they allowed him to do. It was that broad. That's what her testimony was. And the judge said, well, that's kind of ridiculous, right? It can't be that we're going to enforce such a thing as that. That was the first go around. I thought
the court was saying the question then becomes, is it severable?
Well, severable then becomes another.
Severable.
Shall I turn to severable or? Or is there more I should give you, Judge
Holmes?
You
can turn to whatever you want to turn to.
I want to turn to whatever's bothering you.
Well, then what's bothering me is
severable. Yeah. Okay. Well, Your Honor, let's talk about severability. The clause is written only as a prohibition. Nobody disagrees with that, right? As it was written, it's a prohibition. There's no choice in that agreement that allows Mr. Lawson to compete and only give up the money. It's in the exact opposite of what's in Weber. Weber says you can't compete. Alternatively, you can pay 6 months of your bonus to us and then you can compete. And the court applied the reasonableness test even where there was a choice. In our case, there is no choice. And the challenge prohibition itself determines the enforceability, not the remedy sought. And the court below, it's not even clear what was severed, right? There's no language that's identified. There's no term that was stricken, no provision that was stricken that then allows the rest of it to be enforced. That wasn't done.
Well, perhaps I didn't understand you, but he did compete. That's why we're here.
No, he didn't compete.
Look, he was a part of this company that invested in a competitor of his former employer. So he did compete. He just wants the benefit that he was deprived of.
No, I don't think it. The court certainly didn't find that he competed.
What was the conduct that brings us here now?
They found the opposite. The court found the opposite, that even Arconic didn't compete. So it's not about competition. It went way beyond competition. He lost all that he earned, or the bulk of what he earned, as a result of the enforcement of that provision. That's the reality. It had nothing to do with competition. In fact, they even say, that his spirit even says, that we're not talking about competition here. We were trying to protect confidential information.
Well, are you saying then that the conduct in which he engaged in was not within the scope of the agreement here?
No, that was already found. We're challenging the scope. We're not saying it didn't fall within the scope.
Well, if it fell within the scope and it is a non-competition provision, then he competed, right?
No, that's assuming that's what the court found. He did not compete. There's no finding that he competed. It's called a non-compete clause, but its problem is its overbreadth. Its problem isn't how you're going to enforce it. The term expanding the ability to forfeit money or to take away anything from him as a result of doing what is not allowed there is to take away all of his money. And nothing changed. Nothing about competition is actually in there. They didn't want it. And if I can...
Yes. I haven't had a chance, and I've got a couple of things I wanted to ask you about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just backing up on to severability.
Yes.
Could you explain why severability matters, the issue matters when Spirit is disavowed seeking an injunction or damages, and the issue is really whether the Weber reasonable test must be applied?
Well, it's whether the reasonable... I agree with that, Your Honor, but not the severability issue. I don't think... That the court shies away from the language of the prohibition. And here I'm thinking of the Ibdeis case, right? Where the court specifically said, it's not the remedy, and it's certainly not the remedy that the party chooses to pursue. It's the terms of the non-compete itself. Well, are they too broad?
Right. I guess just to put a finer point on it.
Yes.
If we address the severability issue and decide it one way or another, is that really what is going to determine the outcome of this appeal? Seems to me what we're really talking about is your argument that the Weber test ought to apply to the non-compete clause.
Yes, that's part of it, but also the severability that occurred didn't change anything. That's a different way. I mean,
all right.
Isn't that the whole point? At least as I understood Judge Matheson, if it didn't change anything and it's not relevant, then why do we need to talk about that?
I mean, well, because that's what the court told the district court to do, and I think they started with the proposition of, is this like any ordinary non-compete clause? And what the trial court said was, no, it's not the same. It's more burdensome. That's the difference between it. Well, it's not that it's different in some other way. And it's also not one that gave him an alternative. He doesn't have any alternative there. Really, what the court has done is they've made this an employer's choice jurisdiction. The employer can say anything in a non-compete against an official like him. Anything.
I've got one other.
And they then enforce it.
One other question that we haven't talked about. But
yes.
You argue that if we decide that the Weber test does apply,
yes,
that we should go ahead and apply it.
Yes.
My question to you, though, and considering that the previous panel called that a fact-intensive inquiry,
yes,
do we really have all the facts that we would need to decide that issue?
You absolutely do, Your Honor. There was a 9-day trial. There's extensive testimony. Some of it was put before you.
Wouldn't it be better for the district court to decide that in the first instance? After all, it presided at the trial, knows the evidence, heard the witnesses.
Well,
why would we want to dive into that?
Well, for a number of reasons. Yeah, I think the first reason is why the court actually decided what business meant. I mean, the trial court didn't do that, but the circuit court said, well, look, we know the language and we have the record, so we can decide that. The identical thing can be done here. I don't know why it's different. In fact, what we're relying on is the findings by the trial court about the fact that he earned the money, the fact that its value was because he performed, the fact that Spirit received the full benefit of what he did. Spirit isn't harmed by anything that was done. That's already been found. He didn't compete. He didn't do anything that hurt them. He didn't undermine their business. He didn't disclose any confidentialities. He didn't do anything. So I think, Your Honor, that I hope that answers the question. I'm not sure if it does. You can tell me if I did. You may not agree with it. I understand that. But that's what happened. And right now we have findings on every important subject. And let's remember the four-part test and the threshold is, was it supposed to be applied? Kansas has applied it in every situation.
To a condition precedent situation?
Whatever it's called, the condition precedent?
No, to a condition precedent situation. Is there a Kansas case that's on all fours applying the Weber test?
There is not a case
like this.
Yes, there's not a case on all fours, but the condition precedent shouldn't change whether the court analyzes and considers the scope of the restriction.
That's why we're here. Yes. To determine that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to save 2 minutes if I can.
I don't know whether where that's going to play out, but you will get some rebuttal time. You're already 38 over.
I'm over?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Sorry, Your Honor. I missed it. Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, Morgan Ratner for Spirit AeroSystems. I want to be clear that there are three independent grounds for affirming here. The first is what the district court correctly found, which is conditions to future payment are not traditional non-competes, and Kansas does not review those for reasonableness. Also, part of that is, as the district court correctly found, any application of this particular covenant aside from that condition to future payment is not at issue and would be severable if it were a problem. Second independent ground is, even if this is viewed as a traditional non-compete, it is reasonable under the four-part Weber test. And third independent ground, if for whatever reason this would be unenforceable, then Mr. Lawson still can't come in here and demand that Spirit pay. This was the nub of the bargain. So if it goes, then both sides' obligations go as well. So a lot of the questions, I think, relate to this first argument. So let me talk through a factual and a legal point that I want to be clear on.
And before you do that, let me be clear. What is your view, following up on Judge Matheson's point earlier, as it relates to the second? If we got to the point where we were actually applying the Weber or Weaver test and of reasonableness, why wouldn't we let the district court do that as opposed to us doing it?
So I think the district court has almost applied that in the alternative. I would point you to pages 22 to 24 of the district court's opinion, where the district court went through all of the many factors this court would look to. It said, this is not oppressive. This was a bespoke agreement. Mr. Lawson was not kept from making a living. This does not hurt the public interest. Basically, all of the four Weber factors the district court already discussed. So given that this litigation has been going on for 6 years now, I think this court has everything in front of it that it would need to affirm on that second ground.
Okay, I know conclusion and finality is a good thing, but the point is almost all or all? I mean, do you think that there is anything else that needs to be fleshed out before we make a determination if we got to that?
I do not. I think you have the first factor. Is there a legitimate interest? There is clearly under Kansas law a legitimate interest in protecting confidential information. We are talking about protecting a former CEO and current consultant. Recall that this applies only during his current consultancy term from participating in a particular segment of the aerospace industry. On the second Weber prong, undue burden, the aerostructure and aircraft components is one of five or six segments in the aerospace industry. So yes, the conditions are written broadly, but only for that narrow segment. The consequences are also narrow. He can go work for Elliott. He can go work for Arconic. What he can't do is get a paycheck from Spirit. At the same time, it gets a paycheck from someone involved in a competitor. On the public welfare ground, Kansas courts are pretty clear that the only time that's implicated is if, say, you have a shortage of doctors in a particular area.
I heard your opposing counsel, if I heard him correctly, say that Arconic was not a competitor of Spirit.
So that's incorrect as found by the district court. In its most recent decision, it described Arconic as a major supplier and sometimes competitor. This court's previous decision described Arconic as a maker of some of the same aerostructures and aircraft components as Spirit. So you can call that whatever you want, but I think in common parlance, we would call that a competitor. And recall that we're talking about the majority shareholder in that competitor. And we're talking about a former CEO advising that majority shareholder on the strategic direction of a competitor. I don't think that there's any circumstance in which a Kansas court would say that that's not pursuing a legitimate interest. The last point on Weber is reasonable territorial in time. 2 years is sort of the standard on time. On territory, there's been some hints at possibly a dispute about whether Spirit has a geographical range that's international. I would point the court to page 103, where Mr. Lawson agreed that it does, and page 137, where the district court already found that. So given all that, I think a Weber decision is pretty straightforward here, the second of the options I described. But I do want to address the first option as well. The factual point that we should start with is this is a condition to future payment. This is not earned in the sense that Mr. Lawson was entitled to it in any way. I think the undisputed record is if he had retired, these shares would have lapsed. That's at Appendix 351, District Court finding of fact. You can also look at Supplemental Appendix 213 to 224, which are the particular awards at issue. And if that weren't enough, you could look at Appendix 106 that specifically says if you leave Spirit, you will be entitled to retain only those shares previously that have otherwise vested at that time. So as a factual matter, this is a condition to future payment. And then the question is, Chief Judge Holmes's question, does that matter? Does that matter legally? And I think it does. There's a very significant difference, a distinction with a difference here between a circumstance like this and a circumstance like in Varney. And the difference is, if it is a condition, it is a choice, not a penalty. You can never be worse off for having that choice. And that means you can never be essentially deprived of the opportunity to earn a living, which is the fundamental reason why Kansas courts consider traditional non-competes for reasonableness in the first place. So that's a real economic difference between...
You said you were turning to the legal side of this, not the factual side of it. Let me say there is an economic difference. It seems like we're sliding back into the facts. What I'm interested in is whether you have a Kansas case that resolves this.
I think the Kansas case we have is Miller. The Miller case involved a retirement agreement that said, if you retire from our law firm and you want to keep collecting retirement payments, great. If you'd like to go work in the legal profession, your retirement payments will stop. We think that's exactly on all fours factually. Now, the bulk of the Miller decision was addressing that as a legal ethics rule. But at the back half of the opinion, the court then turned to Kansas public policy and more generally said, this is why it's part legal and part factual, Your Honor, said when we're not dealing with something that's coercive, when we're dealing with something that's a choice, there's no implication for Kansas public policy.
Did the district court rely on Miller?
The district court didn't. It cited Miller in its initial analysis, but then did not in this particular section. I think it relied on, I would consider there sort of four indicators of Kansas law here, Miller being one. The district court relied on the three others. One is the Varney decision, which Mr. Lawson points to, which draws the line at we review something as a non-compete for reasonableness, this is a quote from 1016, if the effect of the provision is to prevent a withdrawn partner from earning income by competing. Again, that's where the legal and the economic blend together. The rule, the line drawn in Varney is this keeping you from earning a living? And so that line in Varney, we think, dovetails perfectly with Miller. The district court then looked to the other indicators of Kansas public policy, one being Kansas's very strong background as a contractual freedom state. It follows Delaware a lot in that regard, and the Delaware Supreme Court as the party's 28J.
Yeah, but it also has the Weber test, which other states have not adopted.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. Most states do subject traditional...
Well, all states?
I'm not sure about all states, but most states subject traditional non-competes
well,
to review
you know, you're both asking us to make a prediction of what the Kansas Supreme Court would say on this issue, and we have full briefing on a motion to certify. Why shouldn't we let the Kansas court decide this? It's their law.
Yeah, so I think it's not timely and it's not necessary. On the timely side, again, this case has been going on for 6 years now. We've had this exact issue briefed previously before this court, in the district court, and now this court again. So I think to give plaintiffs to give Mr. Lawson a third bite at the apple at this late stage is not consistent with the court's ordinary certification practice. But more to the point, we have indicators from Kansas on a traditional.
There is an ordinary practice, but go ahead.
The best I can tell from this court's practice. You know, I think more to the point that it's not necessary. The question for certification is usually, is this a novel point where we don't have guidance from Kansas? Here we have, Kansas has guidance on traditional non-competes and why we have them. We have guidance in Miller on conditions to future payments. We have guidance on penalty payment provisions in Varney and why the line is drawn there. This is not an area where you don't have data points and a clear principled way forward. And again, I think if the court has any doubt on that, then that's just a reason to affirm on the separate application of the four Weber factors. I do want to address severability briefly because that...
What about your third ground to affirm?
Sure.
Can you just explain that a little bit?
So we haven't discussed that at all yet, but if in fact this is an unenforceable provision, so you've already found first that you're reviewing it for reasonableness and second that it's unreasonable under the four-part test, which I think would be a pretty dramatic conclusion in light of Kansas courts' repeated upholding of these types of provisions. If you've done all that, then the question is, well, does the contract still stand? Or have we lost an essential part of the bargain? And I think it's very clear from the contract itself and from the party's conduct that this provision, this covenant, was an essential part of the reason why Spirit agreed to pay $31 million to Mr. Lawson. Remember, we're here not because of anything Spirit is doing, but because Mr. Lawson is saying, I should get paid anyway. His argument is that provision was unenforceable and you still owe me $31 million. And so the question is, well, if that provision goes, then what's left of the contract? Does Spirit's obligations go as well? There are comparable decisions we cite in our brief from the Fourth and the Fifth Circuits.
So when you say that provision goes, what specifically are you referring to?
So if the covenant to future payments is rendered unenforceable, then the question is, was that the basis for Spirit's agreement to pay $31 million? And it was. It was at least one of the essential things that Spirit was getting in the bargain was this agreement by Mr. Lawson. So if Spirit's not getting its bargain anymore, then Mr. Lawson doesn't get his bargain either. Again, I would point you to the Fourth and Fifth Circuit decisions, in particular the Chalene decision, which is on exactly these types of
But
facts.
In those cases, those two cases that you're pointing out, wasn't that the only consideration at play?
It was not, Your Honor. The other types of considerations were very similar to things here, like an agreement to leave one's position and not bring any claims and the like. And the courts there said, well, you're an at-will employee anyway, so that agreement, sort of the agreement to leave, is not worth a whole lot. And you don't have any claims that you've raised, so the agreement to give up claims is not really a whole lot. And so we know that the nub of the agreement really is the additional agreement to act like an employee, which means to not disclose confidential information and to not compete or participate again in this segment of the industry. So I think just as much as the first two grounds, that's a ground that is available for this court. I think the sort of logically antecedent ground is for this court to say, look, there's no reason to evaluate this for reasonableness at all because it is a choice. It's a carrot, not a stick.
So on this third ground, you're saying that this non-competition was the only basis for this arrangement that would result in him being paid or not paid?
I'm not saying it's the only basis. The question is, was it an essential basis? And I'm saying it was an essential basis. We know that it was repeated at multiple points throughout the contract. It's really the only obligation that has some legs to it, that there's not really an independent legal obligation on Mr. Lawson, or is negligible in the terms of the Fifth Circuit decision I was pointing to. At bottom, I think, again, the first logically antecedent point is the cleanest in many ways. This is a choice, not a penalty. He could never be worse off for having this choice. And at the end of the day, all Spirit is saying is that you can collect a paycheck from us, or you can collect a paycheck from others in our narrow segment of the industry. But what you cannot do is collect both.
Speak to me about narrow segment. I understood from your opposing counsel that essentially you couldn't do anything.
I'm not sure why he has that belief. It is a broad condition on the types of activities, but it applies only to the aerospace and aircraft components segment, which the testimony at trial is one of five or six segments in the aerospace industry.
Was Mr. Lawson able, was there enough testimony as to whether Mr. Lawson was capable of doing anything other than this narrow segment that you pointed out?
Yes. So Mr. Lawson had previously been on the defense side, which isn't really related to any of this at all. He could have gone back to the defense side. He had asked about an opportunity in avionics, which is aviation electronics, for a company called L3. Avionics is a different segment of the aerospace industry. Spirit had no objections to that. And so, again, we are talking about a broadly worded clause. It is not unprecedented in its wording. I would point you, for example, to the Cantor Fitzgerald opinion out of the Delaware Supreme Court that just came down. I point you to the Kansas's own Fultz decision, which upheld a 10-year non-compete. It's certainly not unprecedented. It's broad, but in a narrow segment and with narrow consequences. The consequences being give up your paycheck from us, get your paycheck from someone else.
Thank
there
you,
are
counsel.
No further questions. Thank you.
2 minutes.
So it seems we agree that this court has. So it seems we agree that this court has all it needs to be able to resolve whether the reasonableness test was satisfied. They say it leads to the conclusion that they win, and we say that it leads to the conclusion that we win. And for judicial efficiency, I realize that's not the only reason. Since there is enough, sending it back is not really required because the findings are there. Now, we hear, I don't know how the my learned opponent can say that the court found that there was competition here. If you look at the findings from 93 to 102, the court describes in meticulous detail how they didn't consider themselves competitors. They weren't identified in their public statements as competitors. They never competed on any program. Spirit had all of its programs tied up. 97% of its business was from two customers on long-term contracts. So this went way beyond competition. It just did, and I think that's the reality that undermines the main argument. Separately, Your Honor, they rely a lot on these, well, it's just a forfeiture provision. Every single case they rely on, every one, does not have a prohibition against any future action. It only has a provision that says, if you do this, you'll lose the money. That's it. In fact, almost every case makes the important distinction that it's a forfeiture for competition if, in fact, there is no prohibition. If there is a prohibition, it is then a non-compete clause, and even in those jurisdictions that accept forfeiture for competition, they say, if you have this preclusion, if the words don't let you do it, it's over. You must have the ability, the choice to do it. There was no choice here, Your Honor.
He could not work. What I heard opposing counsel say a number of times is that that he was not worse off. He can either take a paycheck from Spirit, or he can take a paycheck from somebody else and walk away from this money that he would have gotten. But the money was not his to begin with. unless he did what they asked him to do.
No, but the question is, did he earn that money, Your Honor? And what did he do? And I think this is an important consideration. He turned around a company. They got the full benefit, every possible benefit from his work. The quid pro quo is he gets stock, which if he's successful, it goes up.
If he stays.
No, that's only if it vests. But that's confusing vesting with what he did and what he got as compensation. The stock itself is compensation. It's his. Now, he can't monetize it. But the non-monetizable...
Okay, it's not monetizable.
But that's
and
true.
And so I have stock in my pocket that has zero value. What good does that do me?
Well, so does the $10 million that would be sitting in the company's coffers. It's the same thing. In fact, Varney, and I think Varney's really critical, it says that an economic penalty is, particularly when it's severe, is just like a preclusion. It's the same thing. The employee would be concerned, and it's restraining his ability because it has an impact on whether he can do something or whether he can't.
Okay, it's my fault that I took you down this road and extended the conversation.
No.
So I think we need to end now. You're over the time that I allotted for a rebuttal. This has been a fascinating subject. Good arguments on both sides, and the court is in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.